From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy More. Today, a conversation with filmmaker Michael Moore.
Now, he's taking aim at America's most controversial subject.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States has bowed to almost unanimous international opposition offered to soften its stance on UN weapons inspections. The compromise Security Council resolution, effectively accepted by Russia but awaiting French approval, would threaten serious consequences if Saddam Hussein failed to comply with inspections, but there's no explicit reference to military action. Diplomats say Washington had also suggested it might drop its earlier insistence that future weapons inspections should be bolstered by UN troops and that individual member states could decide whether UN resolutions had been violated. If Baghdad failed to comply, the U.S. would consult the UN Security Council again before going to war, but it would not necessarily seek a second resolution, as the French have demanded. The Congressional War Resolution, which was passed last week, does not require a UN Security Council resolution for Bush to invade Iraq. The U.S. compromise came a day after the largest political grouping at the United Nations rejected, quote, any type of unilateral action against any member state of the United Nations. The 114-member non-aligned movement, which represents the overwhelming majority of the 191 U.N. member states, said it just does not want a war with Iraq. The coalition urged the Security Council to allow U.N. arms inspectors to return to Iraq without further delay. On Thursday, the non-aligned movement wrapped up a non-binding two-day debate on Iraq. Meanwhile, Iraq's main opposition group says a post-Saddam government would review existing oil field development deals with French and Russian companies and could favor U.S. firms instead. Sharif Ali bin al-Hussein, a spokesperson for the U.S.-backed Iraqi National Congress, told Reuters his group would open the oil sector to all companies, including the U.S. major corporations. Hussein's comments will provide fuel for those who allege that one of Washington's prime objectives in seeking to oust the Iraqi president is get its hands on Iraqi oil. The U.S. denies that charge. Russian oil company Lukoil has said it is pressing Moscow to seek guarantees from Washington that it'll safeguard Russian interests in Iraq after Saddam, but there is no evidence that France is making a similar push. The report comes a week after the New York Times revealed that the White House is developing a detailed plan modeled on the post-war occupation of Japan to install a U.S.-led military government in Iraq if the United States topples Saddam Hussein. Under the White House plan, an American military officer would be put in charge of Iraq for a year or more, during which time the United States would also maintain control of Iraq's oil fields. Iraq has the second largest proven reserves of oil in the world, nearly 11% of the total. The United States and France are worried North Korea could attempt to blackmail them over weapons of mass destruction. Speaking at the end of a two-day visit to Washington, the French defense minister, Michel Alliot-Marie, said U.S. officials underlined the risks that North Korea could exercise blackmail with the weapons of mass destruction issue or sell them to possible terrorists. But the U.S. is stressing that the Iraq and North Korea situations are not comparable, despite the fact that President Bush has labeled them both as parts of the axis of evil and that both possess weapons of mass destruction. In the Gaza Strip on Thursday, Israeli tanks killed eight Palestinians, including two children. The killings come a day after President George Bush met with Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon in Washington to ask him to curb the alarming number of Palestinian civilians killed by Israeli forces. Among the latest dead were a 4-year-old girl and a 12-year-old child, 2 young men and 2 elderly women. Witnesses said the Israeli tanks fired 3 shells at houses and blasted them with heavy machine gun fire after Palestinian militants fired on Israeli army bulldozers building a wall on the Egyptian border. Investigators hunting the Washington sniper are preparing to interrogate al-Qaeda detainees at Guantanamo Bay, intelligence officials are saying. This marks the first indication that authorities are seriously considering a terrorist connection to the unsolved string of murders, this according to the Guardian of London. The FBI plans to pass news of the shootings to suspected terrorists held in Cuba and elsewhere, hoping they will discuss it with their fellow prisoners in their cells, which are bugged. 4 days after the unseen sniper killed a 9th person at the closest range yet, less than 30 yards, police spent much of yesterday trying to extinguish unreliable eyewitness reports. Descriptions of the sniper as being olive-skinned or of Hispanic or Middle Eastern appearance, as Wolf Blitzer said on CNN, were not credible, police say. Nor was one witness's account of having seen the gunman race away in a cream-colored van. In related news, the CIA reported Thursday that al-Qaeda is once again as serious a threat to the United States as it was in the months before last year's September 11th attacks. And AIDS activists held rallies and demonstrations in several cities around the world on Thursday to protest against global soft drink giant Coca-Cola, which they charge must help and treat its HIV-infected workers and their families in sub-Saharan Africa. One of the larger demonstrations was in Paris. And you are listening to Democracy Now! A compromise over Iraq looks imminent at the deadlocked UN Security Council, with Washington about to offer a deal acceptable to Council co-members France and Russia. The deal would enable arms inspectors to start work in Iraq next week, back with only an implicit threat of force, diplomats say. A likely U.S. draft resolution would set in place a 2-stage process convening the Security Council before any military attack on Iraq. But if the new proposals were designed to win French and Russian backing, U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell again made it clear the United States is prepared to act without the Council's approval if necessary. He said in New York, the United States is now operating behind the authority given to the president by a joint resolution of the Congress. Meanwhile, the London think tank, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, predicted in its annual military balance report that a U.S.-led war on Iraq is now a probability within the next 6 months. Although it may be the 11th hour in Baghdad, the streets are teeming with humanity. Life goes on under the shadow of the sword. Today, Democracy Now! Continues with Iraq Journal, with our 6th story from Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill, produced with independent filmmaker Jackie Suin.
These late-night sessions in the basement of the Baghdad Museum predate the Gulf War. They predate the Iran-Iraq War. For decades, these men have crowded into this smoke-filled room to drink tea, wave their prayer beads, and sing their way through the strife and the pain. And as they sing, across the Atlantic, plans are again being laid for war. The songs sung in this basement are epic ballads from Iraq's vast history, and no one here believes America can ever destroy that. And those are sentiments you hear everywhere here in Baghdad. Dr. Abdul al-Hashimi is president of Iraq's Organization for Peace, Solidarity, and Friendship. He's a former ambassador and a former federal minister.
Iraq is a surviving nation for thousands of years. It's going to continue to survive. The Mongols destroyed Baghdad about 600-700 years ago. And you are in Baghdad now. The Americans tried, the American administration tried to destroy Baghdad 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and you are in Baghdad now, as lively as you're seeing it. Iraq is belonging to the Iraqi people. Nobody had the right to tell the Iraqi people what to do. If President Bush promises the Iraqis a life like it is in Afghanistan and the Palestinian people, oh God help the Iraqis, what they are facing.
What the Iraqis are facing right now is that President Bush has been given authority by the U.S. Congress to unilaterally attack their country. This week, an open debate on Iraq is taking place at the United Nations, where the Bush administration is pushing a Security Council resolution that the Iraqis say reads like an occupation agreement. The resolution demands that Iraq allow armed forces inside the country with the weapons inspectors, that the U.S. and other permanent members of the Security Council can send in teams of their own that must be given totally unrestricted access to the country. The Iraqis say this means the U.S. could openly send in spies to make target lists for future attacks on the country, as the Clinton administration did in 1998. That's why Dr. Al-Hashimi calls the resolution a setup.
Well, the way this draft resolution is written, definitely it was written not to be implemented. Simply because it's not Iraq that doesn't want to implement, no. Because Iraq cannot implement. It is impossible for Iraq to implement. So the intention of the American administration is, you see, they issue a resolution, so Iraq is not implementing, so Iraq not in compliance with the resolution, so bombs and rockets start to come. That's what they are planning. So this is something, it's a well-known fact now to the international community, to every foreign minister, whether in the Security Council or outside the Security Council. They might attack Iraq tomorrow. And they might attack Iraq 2 weeks from now, 3 months from now, 2 months from now, a year from now. When they decide to do it, they will do it, and no international community, no public opinion can do anything about it. Simply because the American administration, they don't take that into account. They don't respect international opinion. They talk about democracy, but they don't respect their own democracy inside the United States.
Here in Baghdad, it's beginning to feel like the 11th hour. The Iraqis are still working every diplomatic angle. And for now, Russia, France, and China are opposed to Bush's resolution. But despite these divisions at the Security Council, no one here has any illusions about the prospects for averting a war. And Dr. Al-Hashimi sees the Bush administration wagging the dog.
Some American administration officials, they think that exporting problems outside will solve the problem. This is on the contrary, it will complicate that. Plus the oil of Iraq, that is for the oil American industry, which you know who is running it, Texas Group and others. So thinking that taking over the oil of Iraq plus the American companies working in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia will solve the problem, and will use it to press and to blackmail and to make good advantage of controlling the whole area, the whole oil of the Middle East. This is another objective. They cannot do that with President Saddam Hussein in Iraq. So they are calling for change of system of government in Iraq. Not for the love of Iraqis, not for the love of democracy, human rights, or as if they are afraid of the mass destruction weapon of Iraq. No. International community is no longer believing this. But the game is wide open now with American objectives in Iraq. Definitely now, I can tell you very sure that Iraqis will never give up. Because if they give up, they have a lot to lose. That is Iraq. And no Iraqi wants to lose Iraq. That's for sure.
For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Baghdad.
That report by Jeremy Scahill and produced with independent filmmaker Jackie Suen on the ground in Baghdad. Special thanks to Rick Rowley of Big Noise Media, Big Noise Tactical Media, Norm Stockwell of WORT in Madison, and Noel Rabinowitz. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio, the exception to the rulers. Maybe you've seen it already. It just opened this week. Michael Moore's new film, Bowling for Columbine.
Open up an account.
Okay, what type of account would you?
I want the account where I can get the free gun.
You do a CD, no, and we'll hand you a gun. We have a whole brochure here that you can look at.
Mm-hmm.
once we do the background check and everything.
Right.
It's yours to go.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the account I'd like to open.
We have a vault, which at all times we keep at least 500 firearms.
500 of these you have in your vault?
In our vault.
Wow.
We have to do a background check.
At the bank here? Or?
At the bank, which we are a licensed firearm dealer.
Oh, you are? Mm-hmm. You're a bank and a licensed firearm dealer. What would I put for race? White or Caucasian? Or
Caucasian.
Oh, I knew you were going to make me spell the Caucasian. Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't think that's the part they're going to be worried about.
Have you ever been adjudicated mentally defective, or have you ever been committed to a mental institution? Oh, I've never been committed to a mental institution. What does that mean? Have I ever been adjudicated mentally defective?
Would be something involved with a crime.
Oh, with a crime. Okay. So if I'm just normally mentally defective,
yeah,
but not criminal.
Exactly.
There you go, Mike.
Okay, thank you very much. Wow.
I have one personally.
That's a nice sanction.
It is, and it's
a straight shooter.
It's a straight shooter, let me tell you.
Wow. Sweet. Well, here's my first question. Do you think it's a little dangerous handing out guns in a bank?
Bowling for Columbine. Filmmaker Michael Moore joins us for the hour in the studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mike.
Thanks for having me here again, Amy.
It's great to have you here. For people who don't know Michael, documentary filmmaker, television producer, author, former editor of Mother Jones magazine, and The Voice in Flint, Michigan. In 1989, produced his first feature-length documentary, Roger and Me, which looked at the devastating effect of the loss of the GM factory in Flint, Michigan, and the citizens there. According to the LA Times, it remains the highest grossing narrative documentary in the history of American film. His best-selling book now out, Stupid White Men and Other Sorry Excuses for the State of the Nation, which was almost pulped by the publisher after September 11th, is in its seventh month on the New York Times bestseller list and is now in an unprecedented 31st printing. Probably at this point, it's gone beyond. Bowling for Columbine is his latest film. In France, at the Cannes Film Festival, it was the first documentary in competition in 46 years. The jury awarded it a special 55th anniversary prize. And I'm glad you're back here in the United States, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
Wow. So it is breaking box office records already. Talk a little about Bowling for Columbine in this time, in this day, in the United States.
Well, the film, probably I should say right from the beginning, isn't about guns or Columbine or school shootings. I mean, it is the jumping off point in the film. What I wanted to say in this movie goes far beyond that. I wanted to take a look at why, you know, when the NRA says don't kill people, people kill people. I came to believe that they were partially right when they say that, except I would alter it to guns don't kill people, Americans kill people, because we're the only ones who do this. And we do it not just personally and locally, we do it globally. And I wanted to take a look at the connections between the kind of local and personal violence to our global violence, and why we always want to just run in and, you know, bomb another country because we don't like what they're doing. So that is sort of the journey through the film. And I wanted to know, too, why Canada, who turns out to have, they've got like 7 million guns and 10 million homes, why they have all these guns laying around, they don't shoot each other. And what is it about their society that's different from ours? And so that became the, you know, the sort of mission of the movie. But through my particular eye and lens, in the way that I, you know, am want to look at things.
Well, we have to break, and we're going to come back after this musical interlude. Michael Moore is our guest. We're going to hear some clips from the movie through this hour. And also, you were on Crossfire, and that was quite a moment. Usually on Crossfire, they say from the left and from the right, and the guest has a protector, either the guy on the right or the guy writer. But in your case, they were both punching, but you certainly were punching back, and we're going to go to a clip of that as well. We're talking with Michael Moore, filmmaker. His new film, Bowling for Columbine, is just out. Stay with us.
He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns, they crashed the gate in a great stampede, tipped over milk truck, torched all the feed. Cows have fun. 60 police cars were piled in a heap, covered in cow pies, covered up deep. Much cow dung. Black smoke rising, darkening the day. 12 burning McDonald's. Have it your way. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns.
Cows with guns, Dana Lyons.
I've always felt, I've advocated for many years that during deer season, hunting season, that the deer should be armed so that it would be a fair fight. You know, what is the sport of going after an unarmed deer? You know, I mean, if you want to really make it a, you know, a fair and a fun thing, give the deer guns. But nobody could, you know, I never got anywhere with that idea. So,
well, we're going to go back to your movie. We don't usually play trailers, but we are going to do this one. It sort of puts it all together, has different clips throughout the movies as throughout your movie as trailers do. Michael Moore is our guest for this hour, and his new film out is Bowling for Columbine.
Michael Moore, America's favorite whistleblower, the man in everyone's face, the guy asking the question, are we a nation of gun nuts or just plain nuts?
My name was second highest on the bomb threat list,
which kind of made me mad.
Why? Because you didn't make it to number one?
It would have been kind of like an ego thing there, you know, knowing that I was a number one at something.
I loves my gun.
I'm here to open up an account.
Okay, what type of account?
I want the account where I can get the free gun.
You do a CD and we'll hand you a gun.
Well, here's my first question. Do you think it's a little dangerous handing out guns in a bank?
Now, he's taking aim at America's most controversial subject.
Why do you think we have so many gun murders in America?
Because everybody's first reaction is pull the gun out.
The town of Virgin, Utah has passed a law requiring all residents to own guns.
This is a great place to raise your children.
There has been a terrible shooting.
After Columbine, no one could figure out why the boys had resorted to violence.
Why would kids do this?
You don't think kids say dad goes off to the factory every day. He built missiles. What's the difference between that and the mass destruction at Columbine High School?
I guess I don't see that connection.
United Artists presents the sensation of the 2002 Cannes Film Festival and the only film to win a unanimous jury prize.
And then Moses himself showed up.
From my cold, dead hands.
10 days after the Columbine killing, Charlton Heston came to Denver and held a large pro-gun rally.
How could the NRA come here? To me, it's like they're rubbing their nose in it.
Mr. Heston, I'm a member of the NRA. I was wondering if maybe I could talk to you about the whole gun issue.
Critics are calling it scathing, incendiary, hilarious, and provocative.
Our children had turned into little monsters. But who was to blame?
What were the suspects doing the morning of attack? I'd heard that they were bowling.
Bowling for Columbine.
Why wasn't anyone blaming bowling for warping their minds?
A movie that will have you up in arms.
Thank you for not shooting me.
And that is the trailer for Bowling for Columbine. You are listening to Democracy Now! Filmmaker Michael Moore is our guest. Charlton Heston, little part in there where you go to make an appointment to see Charlton Heston. Amazingly, you get to see him.
Yeah, it was. I'd already given up on. We tried for 2 years to get an interview with him, and they just all those people kept me away. So I decided not to do it. And we were out in Los Angeles shooting some of the other things for the film.
So it gives new meaning to the term shooting.
Yeah, to shooting, right? And we were we checked out of the hotel, the crew and myself, and we're heading down Sunset to the 405 to, go to our next location. And one of the people in the crew van saw the star map sign on the street, where you can buy maps to find, you know, where the stars live. And she goes, "Oh, let's get a star map and see if we can find Heston's place." I said, "No, those things are tourist traps. They're not real." And then suddenly everybody in the van's going, "We want a star map. We want a star map." I'm going, "Oh, all right, pull over." So I just pulled over. We got the star map. And I really didn't think this would be his place, you know. Just go up there, and we rang the buzzer. And out of this little box comes the voice of Moses, you know. I just, like, jump back. And I was like, "Oh, no, what do I do now? You know, I'm supposed to be at the airport." It was like, so many times when I'm making a film, it's the happy accidents where the best stuff, occurs, as opposed to the things that you plan out, you know, far in advance. And I guess that's true throughout most of life, isn't it, Amy? the stuff that you've worked so hard to plan never turns out to happen, but occasionally you get a few surprises.
So you make the appointment and you go the next day and you see Charlton Heston. I think what's amazing in the movie is we know about these gun rallies of Charlton Heston as the head of the NRA, but we forget what happened after Columbine. Mm-hmm. Forget what happened after one shooting after another. Talk about him and what he's been doing, what these rallies have been.
Well, this is why the NRA is so effective, because they are just, you know, they are so in your face with what they believe in, and their resolve is so strong. Whenever there is a horrible tragedy, a shooting in a place like, say, Columbine, Heston or people of the NRA will actually hold a big pro-gun rally as soon as they can after the shooting, to just rub people's face right in it, to say, "We don't care that X number of people have died here. We're going to keep motoring on with our Second Amendment rights, and you're not going to do anything to stop us from owning the largest assault weapon we want to own." And it frightens people. I mean, it makes the politicians cower to them. They don't represent a majority opinion in the country. The majority of the country, you know, wants gun control. But they're able to, you know, to play this kind of bully role. And in my film, you know, instead of being afraid of the big bad Wizard of Oz, we're sort of, you know, pulling the curtain back a bit and revealing that it's not a big bad Wizard of Oz. It's just a man, and he's a bit frightened himself and frightened of me, in the sense that he, you know, runs away in the middle of the interview. You know, he just kind of gets up and leaves me there.
Talk about what you left.
We were just left sitting there, basically. And I just thought, well, you know, I've got this picture of this 6-year-old girl who was shot to death by a 6-year-old boy in my hometown, and so I decided just to leave it on his doorstep, just as a memorial to her, and for hopefully maybe he'll take a look at this. This was a human being. And a few months after she died, he had come to Flint and held one of these rallies again, you know. And so that, you know, that's what happened.
You also got a chance to see Dick Clark.
Yeah,
he didn't invite you in his van with him.
No. Well, the reason we went to see Dick Clark, and this is where the film, as I said at the beginning, isn't really so much about guns per se, but it's all these underlying causes and reasons, and the 6-year-old boy who had found this gun in Flint and took it into school, his mother didn't see him do this because she was in the process of being evicted. She was forced to, as part of this welfare to work program, to ride a bus, an 80-mile round trip every day to a wealthy suburb in Detroit to work for minimum wage, which still wasn't enough to pay the rent. So she was being evicted, and she didn't want to take the kids out of school, so she put them at her brother's house where the child found the gun. But, of course, the mother isn't there because the mother is up at 5 in the morning to get on this bus and is back at, you know, 9 or 10 at night and doesn't see her kids. And in the movie, where she works in this wealthy suburb is at a restaurant owned by Dick Clark. And so I just wanted to go and ask him how he felt about, you know, that people are paid minimum wage at his restaurant and still can't afford to pay the rent. And that they are down there having to work in this other place, the Fudgery in the mall there. Was her second job. She had two jobs, this woman. Still, you know, couldn't pay the bills on this. You know, would he join with me to try and correct this system or get rid of this welfare to work program? And of course, he was very upset that I was on a, you know, came to see him. But, you know, I consider these to be acts of state-sponsored violence. This is state-sponsored terrorism against the poor. And, you know, the difference between us and Canada, I think, is they've structured their society where their ethic is we're all Canadians. We're all in the same boat. We need to help each other. If one of us gets sick, that person should have a doctor and we should pay for it. One of us loses our job, we should help that person. I mean, that's their attitude. If you hit upon hard times in a place like Canada, you're embraced. You're not a pariah. We, though, our ethic is every man for himself. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You know, me, 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 me. And if you're poor, to hell with you. I mean, we want to beat up on our poor. We want to punish them for being poor. I don't know what this is about us. We just, so many Americans believe that the way to deal with poverty is to punish those who happen to sadly be in that situation. And as a result, I think that we're a worse country as a result of it. And we create this climate of violence by this kind of mean-spiritedness that we allow those in power to, you know, to exert upon those who are the less fortunate.
We are talking to Michael Moore, and his new film is Bowling for Columbine. You can just tell by the title. It's a controversial film, and it's coming out at an incredible time in this country. Right now, the people of greater Washington, D.C. area, Maryland, Virginia, are being terrorized by a sniper on the loose. The headlines are, he kills for fun. One is, who next? Another is, I am God. When I saw these, who next? I am God. At first, I thought it was soon after the U.N. speech of Bush. I thought the media had all turned around. Who next? I thought about people in the rest of the world, which really, it's a kind of global sniper politics.
Right.
It's the randomness of the shooting. Who is he, meaning Bush, going to target next? Yet you have this crisis in Washington with the sniper who's taken out one person after another. And you have gun politics in this country.
Right.
At the same time this is all happening, Bush, behind the scenes, is working against ballistic fingerprinting.
That's right.
Can you explain that?
Yeah. Well, I have many thoughts about this. First of all, the ballistics fingerprinting. We have the technology so we can determine what exact gun a specific bullet comes from. And they use this in other countries. In Bush and the NRA have stopped any sort of ballistics fingerprinting, so that they can help, you know, define whoever this person is or where the gun came from.
On the bullet which gun it came from.
Right, and of course anything that gets near to where they believe is going to violate somebody's Second Amendment right. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter even if it is a criminal or a murderer or whatever. I mean, I honestly believe if you explain these two things to the average American, they would turn against Bush and Cheney so fast. If you tell them, the person you're working with today who doesn't listen to, you know, Pacifica or whatever, just the average, you know, Joe who might, you know, not be aware, they don't read the paper. But if you just tell them this one fact, that George W. Bush does not believe the police should have the right to discover what gun the bullets that are killing these people come from, and that he's trying to protect the Second Amendment rights of the sniper.
It's not only right, not only the Second Amendment rights. Ari Fleischer said
the so-called Second Amendment
you
rights.
You protect because this would invade the privacy of the shooter.
Just repeat Ari Fleischer's words over and over again to everybody you know that they were concerned about the privacy of the murderer. And if you explain that to people, they will like, what? You know, and then back it up. Show them the article. Show them, print it off the website, whatever. Just tell people this. Here's the other thing you can tell people. John Ashcroft, to this day, is still prohibiting the FBI from taking a look at the background check files for the gun purchases, because the FBI wanted to do just a simple thing to find out if any of the 19 hijackers or their associates had purchased any weapons in the 2 years leading up to September 11th. Well, it seems like a normal kind of police investigation thing you'd want to do. You know, what were they up to? You know, did they buy any weapons? Is there still anything else, you know, going on? Ashcroft says to the FBI, no, no. The Brady Bill prohibits this. You are not allowed to violate the privacy rights of the 19 hijackers to find out whether or not they have purchased any weapons. If you explain this to the average person, again, just that they will not even allow to look in the background. Because the Brady Bill, they had to make a compromise with the NRA that doesn't allow the sort of looking into these background check files. They have violated the rights of so many people in this country in the last year or so. People they have rounded up, Arab Americans, Arab-looking people, people that are in jails right now with no charges, no trials. We don't even know who they are. We don't know their names. We don't know how many. We don't know the exact prisons they're in. I mean, there has been a random and massive shredding of the civil liberties and civil rights of so many people since September 11th, and the Patriot Act and all the things that evil bill does in terms of upending our Constitution. That's okay. That's all that stuff's okay. But God forbid that we look in the background check files to find out if the 19 hijackers have purchased any weapons. That would be a horrific violation of the rights of these wonderfully deceased hijacking terrorists. I mean, again, if you just explain that to people, it reveals the fact that these people in charge of the country right now, who are there not at the will of the people, but because they stole the election and they stole the White House, and are sitting there illegally. They are squatters on federal land. If you just explain this to people, they get it. They get it. And you know, it shows just how important the work is that everybody is doing right now to stop Bush and his cronies, because everywhere you turn. And like you said, Amy, it's not just about the sniper. It's, you know, we're the national sniper when it comes to going after countries like Iraq. I mean, the latest enemy, the latest boogeyman that we're now going to drop bombs on, you know, this country or whatever the hell is they've got planned. Innocent people are going to die. You know, we all live in New York, right? I mean, we're here in New York City. And we're all, you know, I think if you ask most New Yorkers, everyone's just kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop. We don't think that we're done with this yet, right? Who in New York tonight is afraid of Saddam Hussein or believes Saddam Hussein is going to harm them? I mean, this is truly one of the biggest lies being perpetrated on people, and it's so distracting because we should be dealing with so many other things, whether it's from things that could be a real threat to people's lives here, or the larger threats that we don't deal with, the fact that we've got 40 million people who live in poverty and nearly 50 million who don't have health care and 40 million adults who can't read and write on a fourth grade level. I mean, that's, to me, those are the things that are going to unravel the society.
The kinds of issues you're talking about, clearly, the way you talk about them very much bothers the New York Times. Your book, which Stupid White Men, Excuses for the State of the Nation, which is bestseller on their list for how
it's
many?
It's been on, I think, 32 weeks now on their list, and now the largest selling nonfiction book in America.
So
this
what
year.
Was the review of your book like?
They haven't gotten around to running it yet. There's been no review. They thought by ignoring it would just go away. And well, the more they ignored it, the more it just kept going up the list. So actually, I'm grateful that they never reviewed it, because You know, if they'd reviewed it, it probably just, you know, would have killed the whole thing.
Well, so they did review Bowling for Columbine. Didn't want to make the same mistake again. And I would like to read a little bit from it. Here, this is by A.O. Scott. And they clearly don't like when you make the international connections. Though he seems to be hunting for a specific historical cause for events like Columbine, Mr. Moore, when it serves his purposes, is happy to generalize in the absence of empirical evidence and to make much of connections that seem spurious on close examination. Several times he notes that the Columbine shootings occurred on the same day as the heaviest United States bombing of the Kosovo War. The more you think about this coincidence, the less it seems to mean. He then goes on to say, he visits, oh, I don't know if it's A.O. Scott.
A.O. is Tony Scott, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. He visits a Lockheed Martin, this is you, he visits a Lockheed Martin plant near Columbine that manufactures missiles and pesters a company flak about the links between the factory's products and the shootings. I guess I don't see that connection, the man says, standing in front of the company's wares. Mr. Moore and the camera clearly take him for a fool, another stupid white man doing his job, but you don't have to be a big fan of nuclear weapons to think that he might have a point. This exchange is followed by a montage accompanied by Louis Armstrong singing What a Wonderful World of American foreign policy misdeeds from the 1950s to the present. Their relevance is again arguable, but by now it should be clear that Mr. Moore is less interested in argument than in provocation. The last images of the airplane smashing into the World Trade Center, accompanied by this text, September 11th, 2001, Osama bin Laden uses his expert CIA training to murder 3,000 people. The idiocy of this statement is hardly worth engaging. It is exactly the kind of glib distortion of history that can be taken as a warrant to dismiss everything Mr. Moore has to say.
Well, there you go, right there. I mean, you know, it's funny. This guy, this critic here, he says at the beginning, everybody in America should see this film. I mean, he clearly likes the film. But you read into it, he's just so bummed out. Well, it's like, Mike, it was really good when you were talking about the school shootings and the guns are bad and the NRA and all that. Why'd you have to go talk about the, you know, people in other countries that were shooting? That's what's that got to do with it? I mean, it's like, you know, kids dying in America, that's good to take a look at that. Kids dying in other countries, what's that got to do with this movie? It's just, I felt bad for when I read this, you know. I was like, because there is this great scene in the film, and it came from me. I was kind of shocked by this fact. I found out when I got there that the number one private employer in Littleton is Lockheed Martin, the world's largest weapons maker. And it was just an honest question to the PR guy at Lockheed Martin. Do you think the kids go, you know, who go to Columbine say to themselves, let's see, Dad spends his day making weapons of mass destruction, you know, that's, they think that's the way to solve problems. Why can't I solve my problems that way? It seemed like a legitimate question to ask the guy. And the guy says, no, we don't see any connection between two of these things, you know, or the fact that Rocky Flats, the largest plutonium making place in the world, is just down the road, or NORAD is just up the road, we've got about 10 missile silos around the area here. No, this has nothing to do with anything, you know. And it's like, and then I go, and then his final line, the PR guy from Lockheed Martin, he says, because the violence these kids did at the school, it's, you know, they got mad at these kids. And as adults, with our missiles that we're building here at Lockheed, we just don't go drop bombs on people because, you know, we're mad at them for something. And it's just like, it just begged, you know, a response. And so for the next 3 minutes in the film, I take the viewers of the film through a little journey to the tune of Louis Armstrong singing What a Wonderful World, of everything that's happened in my lifetime. From the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran to the overthrow of the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Arbenz, to, you know, all the times where we actually have used violence as a means to our ends as the United States of America, and he's offended by the fact, as he says here in this review, that I would dare to mention that Osama bin Laden and his buddies were originally trained by the CIA and given $3 billion to teach them not how to be soldiers, but how to be terrorists, how to commit acts of terrorism against the Soviets when they were in Afghanistan. And you know what? I guess that's a bitter pill for some people to swallow, but be that as it may, it's something that, you know, I'm not going to forget, and I don't want other people to forget it, that we sometimes, as the Dr. Frankenstein, create the Frankensteins. And I also point out in the film the what we gave Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and how we armed him and how we have allowed $4 billion in aid to go to Saddam and how, you know, these biochemical weapons or whatever that they claim that he has, these elements were all shipped by American companies. There's a whole list of them you can get. There was a 1994 Senate report from 85 to 89, all these chemical things that we gave to Saddam. Reagan and Bush won, restored diplomatic relations and full recognition of Saddam in 85, a year after he gassed the Kurds. They didn't give a damn about that then because they wanted him to kill Iranians. At the same time, Ali North is setting it up so we can give arms to the Iranians so they can kill Iraqis. And we're like the puppeteer here, you know, giving arms to both sides to get them to kill each other.
Michael, we have to break. Michael Moore, filmmaker, his new film, Bowling for Columbine. Stay with us. Boy, they're stinking torture states. And when I talk with the survivors of things too sickening to relate, if I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, if I had a rocket launcher, I would. If I had a rocket launcher, Bruce Coburn here on Democracy Now. I like your hat, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for this this new hat.
Democracy Now hat. Michael Moore, filmmaker, with us in Bowling for Columbine. You've got the part with the kids, the victims of Columbine. Talk about this and this whole scene that takes place that clearly surprises you as well from beginning to end. But these two young men now.
The are you referring to which ones? The
kids that were both victims of the Columbine shooting.
Oh, right. Yes. The ones who are still alive.
Right.
Well, the night before the killings of Columbine, the two kids who did the shooting were able to go into the local Kmart and buy hundreds of rounds of ammunition for about 17 cents a bullet. So there are a number of kids who are paralyzed and who are still recovering from their injuries from these bullets. Some of the bullets are still inside them. So I went and visited this one boy. His name is Richard Castaldo, and he's in a wheelchair for life and still has the Kmart bullet inside of him. And another boy, Mark Taylor. And I asked him, I said, you know, I'm going back home to Detroit, and, you know, the Kmart World Headquarters is just outside Detroit. How would you like to go with me and return the merchandise? And they thought, yeah, that's a great idea. So we flew to Detroit and went to Kmart and said, we're here to return the blue light special that's inside their bodies. And, oh, and by the way, we're not leaving until you remove all the ammunition from your shelves that can be used in assault weapons and handguns. And so we just essentially staged our own little stand-in, sit-in for about 5 hours. They sent various people down to try and talk sense to us. You know, they first sent the PR woman. She greeted us and told the boys that she hoped that they were shoppers at Kmart. Told the one boy who was still standing that she was glad that he was able to stand. And but nothing happened. So that night, one of the boys wanted to go to the local Kmart in Detroit and buy up all the bullets so that nobody could, you know, use them. So we went there and we just cleared out the shelves. The next day, we come back with all the bullets that we'd bought at the Kmart along with the local press and told them again, we're not leaving until you remove the bullets. And an hour later, they sent down their vice president with a statement saying, we have decided to...
Did you expect this as she came out?
Oh, no way. Are you kidding? I'm so used to rejection. I mean, it's like, you know, but that goes back to high school. It's a long story. You don't want to hear it. It's a sad, sad, sad state of affairs. But no, I'm just, you can see the look of my face in the movie because it's like this woman's going, within 90 days, all ammunition will be removed from our shelves. And I'm going, what? Could you say that again? I had to repeat it because I couldn't believe that you know, we were this successful within 24 hours. And sure enough, within 90 days, from all 2,300 stores, they removed what usually they have about 2 million rounds of ammo.
And you said even from the assault weapons?
Yeah, from the assault weapons and handguns. Mm-hmm. You can't buy ammunition.
And
now,
how did the young men, one in the wheelchair and one who's moving along with bullets in it?
Oh, it was so empowering. I mean, it was like they made this happen, you know, because if it had been just me and the camera, it would have been the usual, you know, let's give Mike the boot, you know, but they could not, you know, it the thing I always hope for, because I believe, and this is the sort of weird optimism in me, that all human beings have a conscience. And all people actually at their core are good. And somewhere along the line, they learn to not be good, or they learn to forget that they have a conscience. And I just thought, if the people running Kmart could see these boys, one of them in a wheelchair, that somehow it would trigger something inside them, that they would, you know, just, you know, be moved to the point where they would want to do the right thing instead of taking the position of being the good German. Well, we didn't shoot these boys. I mean, we just sold the bullets, you know, to a couple of 17-year-olds. And it wasn't our fault. And remarkably, what happened was is that they were affected by it. And the guy who was the buyer, who actually buys the ammo from the ammo companies, came up to me. He had tears in his eyes. He said, I have a boy this age. I couldn't sleep last night. I mean, they were truly affected by this. And the power of that moment was so incredible. And I can't wait for kids, teenagers, to see this film, because it really shows how, you know, just sometimes by doing just a little bit, by going that extra distance towards something you believe in, you can actually make something happen.
Have you shown Bowling for Columbine in Littleton?
Tomorrow night is the premiere there. We're going out to... It's the closing night film of the Denver Film Festival, and they're going to have a town hall in the afternoon, and the boys are going to be there, and a couple of the parents who lost children, and I think it's going to be a pretty interesting and powerful day there.
You're taking your Kmart campaign. It's going Walmart now. Can you talk about
that?
Well,
on our website, we've got Walmart up there for there's a petition, and we're going to try and get them to remove the ammo from their shelves. It was amazing. We put that up last Friday, and within 6 hours, we had 3 million hits within 6 hours. It blew the server out on our website, and it's just been incredible. I mean, this is again why. I mean, what I've seen this year with the book and on the book tour, the response to that and to the film last weekend when it opened in New York and LA. I'm telling you, Amy, there are so many people out there, so many millions of people that believe in all these things that we talk about, whether it's the stuff in the film, whether it's the stuff on your show. We are not, this is not a minority of people who believe in these things. I truly believe the majority of the country, that we are with them and they're with us on so many, if not most, of these issues. It's just that they're not organized. It's just that that there's no place for them to go. There is no leadership, especially this in the so-called, you know, liberal wing or whatever, even though the Democratic Party. It's just there's no place to turn there. And it's just, but it doesn't mean the people aren't there. I've seen this personally. I mean, I've just personally witnessed this, and I've gone out with Ralph this year, Ralph Nader, to various cities, and still thousands of people showing up. We went down to Tampa, Florida. 7,000 people showed up there, and I mean, the crowds are not in the Berkeleys and in Madisons and Ann Arbors. I mean the crowds are always there, and that's great. But we were getting 7,000, 6,000 people in places like Tampa, Olympia, Washington, Denton, Texas. I mean, just incredible. My website from last January, I was getting like 70,000 hits a month, which I thought, geez, that's a lot of people. I was like, that's a good thing to have a website, right? And last month, the numbers came in, it was 17 million hits in 1 month. Now, that's not because it's a great website. I mean, it's okay. It's got some color pictures on it and stuff. But my point is that there are millions of Americans desperate, hungry. They don't like what's going on. They get it now. They see the corporate crooks that have put Bush in that White House. They don't support this war against Iraq. They don't buy anything that's being told to them by these people. And they're just desperate for some place to go. And I'm telling you, for anybody who's listening, anybody, if you're a local organizer, if you're, active in your community, there couldn't be a better time than right now to get out there and organize people in the places where you haven't organized, to really reach out to people who have seen, their pension funds evaporate, who've seen their 401ks gone. I mean, middle America, the people that assumed that there wasn't, they knew there wasn't going to be Social Security there. So they stupidly, sadly put their money in the stock market or whatever, because they're desperate, because they just want to make sure there's going to be something there when they're old. And now there's not going to be anything. And they've been so ripped off and lied to, and they're so angry right now. There couldn't be a better time to organize people. And I just want to encourage listeners to go out and do that, and to think about running for office yourself, or find that one person in your area that we should be running for city council or school board or Congress.
Well, speaking of running for Congress, you say you're going out to Denver and to Littleton. Rocky Mountain News is reporting the Republican congressman who represents Columbine has been criticized for taking a $1,500 contribution from the National Rifle Association, Congressman Tancredo. 2 years ago, he agreed not to take donations from the gun lobby.
Unbelievable. It's a story like that. And this is our fight constantly, right? Because the average American reads that, and they give up. They go, okay, they're all liars. Look at that. He said he wouldn't take contributions. Now he's taking their money, and he's the guy representing the victims here in that area. And so people stop voting, and they stop getting involved. We have to take stories like that and say, okay, this guy, what's his name? Credo?
Tancredo.
Okay, he's gone. Okay, he's history. This guy, if the Democrats, I'm sure they did, fail to put up a real challenger. This is the lamest political party ever invented, folks, by the way. I don't know if we've...
Has this 10 seconds.
10 seconds to say this?
We're out of here.
It doesn't need to be said. We already know it. November 5th, the Republicans should have been given a shellacking. I hope they still get it, but I don't know if it's going to come from the lame Democrats, but...
The Democrats voted for war.
Exactly. That's what I mean. So people, they feel like they've got nowhere to go, and then you have a low turnout, and then more people give up. So we've got to find reasons for people not to give up.
Well, Michael Moore, Bowling for Columbine is his new movie. It is opening all over the country. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Amy, for being here, and thanks for this show.
And if folks want to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Michael's is michaelmoore.com. Democracynow.org. Our email address is mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Alex Wolf, Anna Noguera. Thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Today.